Hello and welcome to Intelligence Talks. I'm your host, Anna Ward. Today, I'm joined by three Knight Frank living sector experts in our research team. We'll be talking about the role of UK living sectors in reducing housing supply pressures in UK towns and cities. So investment volumes into UK build-to-rent student and senior living hit nearly £10 billion last year, and that's below the record £15 billion that we saw in 2022, but still well above pre-COVID levels. So clearly the investor appetite is there, but what about the beds? Our three experts will be covering each sector, and they'll be sharing their insights on key trends to watch.
Hi Anna, Katie O'Neill here. I am the lead on all things PBSA research in Knight Frank. 16% growth in full-time undergraduate student numbers between now and 2030. That's what we're projecting. In real terms, that's an additional 263,000 students. Last year, though, we just delivered 20,500 new PBSA beds. Now, the shortfall of appropriate accommodation for students in our most popular towns and cities is widening, and that is the thing that underpins the investor story.
Hi, Anna. My name's Lizzie Breckner. I'm an associate within the Living Sectors Research Team, and I lead on all things build to rent and residential investment. The key stat that I want to put forward is, well, it's a number really, 100,000 build-to-rent homes. This is a key milestone that the sector has hit recently in terms of the number of completed homes. And to put that number into context, 100,000 homes equates to about 1.8% of the private rented sector in the UK.
Hi Anna, my name's Sam Heffron. I'm a senior research analyst for the seniors housing team here at Knight Frank. So the stat that I'd like to put at the forefront of your mind is fewer than 1%. And so that is to say that currently the fastest part of the seniors housing sector is what we call integrated retirement communities, notably IRCs. And fewer than 1% of all seniors in the UK currently live in these IRCs.
Okay, so you're picking up quite similar themes, definitely undersupply. In terms of just our next section, so we're now going to look at the news. And I think just to frame this, I think it's important to just bear in mind that obviously housing is so much in the spotlight at the moment. We've got an election coming up. The Competition and Markets Authority has just released a report on house building at large, a number of suggestions and recommendations in there. Some of those actually touch on increasing diversity of tenure and bringing in more sort of living sectors, actually, particularly on sort of larger sites. So with that backdrop, I'd be really interested to know what news stories that you've picked out this week that you think really touch on your sector and why you think that is.
So one news story that we saw last week was a survey conducted by Universities UK. It generated quite a lot of headlines. Essentially, they surveyed 73 universities, and of those, they revealed a 44% decline in thought postgraduate international students. That's in the latest January intake data. Now, essentially, what that survey is citing in part is a bit of a change in the mood music for international graduate students. Essentially, it's around the government's intention to review the visa structuring. Now, Vivian Stern, CEO of Universities UK, is really actively campaigning against moves to scrap or scale back the UK graduate visa route. She's actually doing this by evidencing some estimates from an economic impact study she did, which essentially summarises the direct contribution of international students as $60 billion of an economic boost over the last 5 years.
Sam, what's your news story and why does it matter for the senior housing sector?
So one thing on the news horizon for seniors is that soon we're expecting the findings of the Older Persons Housing Task Force to be published.
When is that coming out?
Over the next couple of months.
Okay.
So it's uncertain, there's no specific deadline. This comes after a year-long ministerial investigation in essentially exploring avenues for improving the supply of purpose-built accommodation for seniors. So for those who aren't aware of what the Older Persons Housing Task Force is, it was established by the government last year as an independent task force to look into strategies to accelerate the supply of seniors housing. Mm-hmm. Now, this kind of independent government task force have been in operation in more mature markets, such as in New Zealand, for instance. They've had a strategic approach for this type of housing in operation since around about 1997.
When did you say this one was set up?
So yeah, so we're about 20 years behind.
Right.
So better late than never, I suppose. But what we're expecting to see, there's kind of rumblings about what the findings and recommendations are going to be. And so kind of the three key ones that we're expecting to see as being published relating to recommendations around use classifications, because these have always kind of straddled the lines in planning terms. It's been kind of... local planning authorities have had to kind of decide whether it's going
to
be...
It's been a bit vague.
Yeah,
to put it
exactly. Between C2 and C3 classes, not to get into the technicalities of that, but it's been fairly ambiguous.
Well, I'd love to hear about C2 and C3. Here
maybe
all day.
Maybe some other time.
Tell me more.
And so we're expecting to see anyway a recommendation as to which of those classifications it should belong to, in addition to a potential fast track for seniors' accommodation.
Okay. So they're sorting the things out that could have been sorted out 20 years ago.
Essentially, the viability challenges that have existed for a while, these kind of recommendations that would give some kind of structure to the sector would make that those viability issues disappear or at least mitigate them. So it'd be the viability challenges and the rate at which these decisions can be made on these.
So is the industry thinking positively about what's in there? Or, I mean,
if these things come to light. These are likely recommendations.
Okay.
So if there is some kind of clarification around this, then it will be seen as a major positive.
We're going to move on to Lizzie and hear about the world of built to rent. What's the big sort of news story that has been interesting you lately on that side of things?
So I've decided to go slightly broader. I've not picked a headline that's directly relevant to the build to rent sector. Mm-hmm. It's slightly sort of one step removed. But I wanted to talk about the news that came out with the High Court ruling on the M&S site on Oxford Street. So what happened was, in 2021, M&S submitted a planning application to demolish and redevelop their flagship store on Oxford Street at Marble Arch. The planning permission was granted, but it was then thrown out by Michael Gove, the Levelling Up Secretary. The High Court overruled this again. And what this is all about is sort of retrofitting versus demolishing and rebuilding. So it's a real kind of ESG related theme here. And there's probably more questions than answers still when it comes to, you know, embodied carbon versus operational carbon. But we've all kind of been working under the assumption for the last little while that there was this presumption in favor of retrofitting, you know, supposed to be better for the planet, etc. But now we've got this decision where actually the M&S building is going to be allowed to be demolished. And it just, as I said, it raises quite a few questions, but it's really relevant for the build to rent sector and kind of the housing market as a whole, really, in the development market. Because across the board, there are distressed assets in the market at the moment. There are permitted development opportunities to convert from, for example, commercial to residential. I mean, we've got clients who are very ESG minded. We've got clients who are looking at opportunities and they're trying to make the right decisions, so to speak, in terms of carbon and, you know, ESG and the planet. And, you know, it's a big decision. Do they attempt to retrofit? Do they attempt to knock it down and start again?
So, Lizzie, the Competition and Markets Authority report highlighted that build to rent currently accounts for roughly 5% of annual supply in Britain. How high do you see that proportion going and how soon?
Great question, Anna. So that proportion could get much, much bigger than it's the current 1.8%. When we look at more mature multifamily and build-to-rent markets abroad, you know, looking at the likes of the US, Germany, the Netherlands, those markets are at more like sort of 30 to 40% market penetration. So the potential is huge. We expect that build-to-rent could account for at least 30% of the private rented sector across the UK. That would equate to about 1.7 million homes based on current household numbers, compared to our fairly meagre 100,000 that we've got so far. But in terms of how long it will take for us to get to that kind of 30% market penetration number, it's going to be decades. Build to rent has been kind of around in at least somewhat of a kind of meaningful way for about 15 years. So it's taken 15 years for us to deliver 100,000 homes. And although we do expect the pace of delivery to increase, you know, to get from 100,000 homes to 1.7 million, we're talking decades.
Katie, you also painted quite a dramatic picture at the beginning of this podcast. And I did actually read the lack of student accommodation right now has been described as an existential crisis, basically, because there aren't any beds. How serious is the situation, though?
serious, just to touch on a point that you're saying there, we are still seeing very strong international student appetite for education in the UK. Just to touch on that, actually, if we look at today's figures, the top domiciles for studying in the UK are England number one, Scotland number two, China number three. By 2030, UCAS are forecasting that it'll be England number one, China number two, Scotland number three. So to surpass another home nation. So just to allude, I know I spoke about the UK universities piece earlier, but we are still seeing very strong international demand. We're seeing too, as well as growing student numbers and supply that's just not keeping pace, we're also seeing a shift in sentiment within students. More and more students want to live in purpose-built student accommodation because they see the benefit it has to their overall education journey. It's not just kind of this bed space narrative that we had a few years ago. It's very much so, how can I get the most from my education experience? How can I get the most from my university kind of intake? And they see as being supported through that journey via their accommodation as crucial.
So when do you envisage we could actually reach a sort of really critical breaking point here? Like, in terms of, I know you mentioned we had a chat before about Dublin and the fact that it's just it's so expensive to rent there, and there's been lots of news stories about people kind of running around putting leaflets through doors to get places. When do you think we could reach a point like that here?
Yeah, we've definitely seen students in neighbouring towns and cities commuting to their university. We have seen that in our most popular towns and destinations. Yeah. I think it's quite important here to differentiate between how mature a student is relative to something like Build to Rent or seniors. Like Lizzie's reference to less than 2% market relative to PBSA, we're at about 30%. So it is quite a large scale difference. So we do have some supply in stock there. It's just we're seeing quite acute shortages in our kind of very popular.
So is it sort of plateauing then? It's sort of staying at that rate. It's not.
Well, it's not increasing at a meaningful pace. And also student numbers are growing. I think too, tying into the point on a financial review and universities feeling a pinch point, ultimately insufficient or unsuitable accommodation options in that university city or town will negatively affect the reputation of that university, because students are going to make choices around obviously their course first and foremost. But if they cannot find accommodation in that city or within that kind of immediate catchment, they will choose to go somewhere else. And at a time where the book isn't really balancing for a few universities across the UK, that's going to be more crucial than ever.
Okay, well, Sam, I'm hoping you've got some good news for me, but I fear you might not, because obviously if we don't sort out the senior housing issue, there's a lot of pressure on the NHS, isn't it? So again, a similar question to you as Katie, really. How serious is this situation?
Well, it's fairly similar, similarly worse, actually, in that, I mean, you were saying about Build to Rent having a market penetration of less than 2%. Well, like I said, the stat that I want to kind of bring to the forefront of your mind is that for IRCs, so the fastest growing part of the market, the penetration rate is less than 1%. So it's less than more mature markets, which is Build to Rent and student. And then if you look at seniors from the international perspective, they're getting around 6%. And then we're getting a government task force to look at, you know, finding a strategy in which to really kind of spur the development in the sector. And it's 20 years later than these more mature markets. So the pinch point, really, I mean, we're already there. It's better late than never, but it's a cause for concern. But the positive thing is that better late than never, these things are proven to show that they enable people to live longer, healthier lives. So it does lift the burden off the NHS, which isn't in its best state at the minute. And so they are getting built, but just not anywhere near the rate that we need them getting built. Again, 50,000 per annum is kind of roughly what we need, and we're building around about 7,500 a year.
Can you share a bit more about what you think the older generations want? Because obviously I understand that if you need care and it has to be 24/7, you sort of, you're someone that knows what you're looking for. But obviously there's a lot of nuance here, because we're talking about accommodation where you still retain quite a lot of independence. There's a bit of support. How can governments encourage that group that want to do that, to effectively downsize from their oversized family housing, unlock that for younger generations?
Well, I think this seems as though this is a new proposition, that's something that doesn't exist in the current market. The best thing to do is take the lead of where it has been successful globally. So if you look at these more mature markets, so the three key ones are the US, Australia, and New Zealand. What they've done, they've got a very good, solid track record of catering to kind of evolving needs of particularly the boomer generation. And they've catered a product that meets directly not only their needs, but their preferences. And so you see in the kind of quantum of amenity that they provide, so a higher amount of these products are very amenitized, and the type of amenities that they need. And so you do have traditional care homes that already exist, but there seems to be this kind of middle ground where it's more focused on lifestyle. And so care options are there if required, but they're not a necessary feature of it.
Thank you. Yeah. I think you've all done an excellent job at just distilling quite nuanced, complicated sectors into a very short space of time for our listeners. That's really great. Elizabeth, you pointed this out earlier, just bearing in mind that those big numbers sound really flashy, but actually if you think about the whole market, it's very small. And I guess conversely, you've obviously mentioned students, actually quite a mature sector, even if it is plateauing a bit. And actually a lot of what you've been talking about, Sam, is sort of very current, isn't it? Sort of the government part of it is changing, and as you say, we're about 20 years behind New Zealand.
Yeah,
so it's
1997
all changing.
Was when they set up their task force in 2023. So
brilliant. Well, thank you all very much for joining me. For more analysis, you can subscribe to our research note, which goes out every Monday, Wednesday and Friday. See our show notes for more details, and please do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and listen out for our next episode in 2 weeks. Thank you for listening to this week's Intelligence Talks.